This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Tom Butler. He is Editorial Project Director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's President of the Northeast Wilderness Trust. He's the author of two books, Wildlands Philanthropy and Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And he's editor of the new book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
It's great to have you on the air. This is a stunning book. It's big, it's heavy, it's a book of photographs and text as well about the entire earth on which we are living, including wildlife, including cities, desperate poverty, all kinds of things. How did this book come into being?
Well, we wanted to jump over many of the rational arguments about population, the rapid growth of the human population and the related overconsumption of the Earth's natural bounty. You know, there is no shortage of books and research reports and demographic data. There's worlds of data about this trajectory of the human population explosion. All of that is good and all of that is useful, but I don't think it really resonates with people, or at least not much anymore. We don't talk about this elephant in the room, this population explosion. And so we wanted to craft a book and the related campaign, populationspeakout.org, that would go right to an emotional connection so that people could see very visually with this slideshow tour of images from around the Earth how the planet is being transformed by 7.3 billion people in the way that we've chosen to organize our economic activities. So leafing through the book, page by page, one can see that transformation, and hopefully anyone who looks at those images in the book or at the website will begin to think about the issue and want to talk about it and have an emotional connection to what is happening to the Earth and to the people who are suffering from, particularly in high-fertility countries.
The photographs are just so beautiful. I mean, obviously they're done by some of the greatest photographers anywhere, and some of them are entirely and sort of purely beautiful, landscapes and animals and so on. Some of them are heartbreaking, some of them are disturbing, and I think it's interesting to sort of note when you leaf through the book which images stick in your mind. And for me, one of them was this surfer who looks like something out of the pages of a kind of extreme surfing magazine, riding the curl of a huge wave, and the wave is filled with garbage. And the book opens up kind of a meditation and kind of a conversation, I think, for the reader on the relationship between beauty and health, beauty and a balanced world.
I'm so glad you got that connection, because that also was very much intentional. We wanted to produce not just, you know, the world's most beautiful, ugly coffee table book, but one that would be sort of broadly representative of, the way the Earth is being shaped, transformed, and degraded by human activity, by our numbers and our behavior. That photograph you reference of the surfer, we had a small editorial team that worked on the project with an excellent photo researcher who is himself a professional photographer. And when he brought that image to us as one of the thousands we considered, and we see this guy surfing this big wave out, you know, in Indonesia and the coast, and it's filled with that solid waste, garbage, I was certain that it was a photoshopped image. I said, that's not real. We can't use that. Go back and track that down and confirm that it's actual image. And he did. And so we chose to use it in the book. But that's a great example of the kind of image that has a sort of aesthetic power to it, because it's a really excellent photograph. But the idea embedded in that image is so shocking. that even the oceans, these great wondrous seas that cover most of the planet, are filled with our detritus, with the trash, the residue of this techno-industrial growth culture, which is the dominant economic model and perceived as human progress.
There are so many facts that concerned people, concerned citizens already know, the problems that we have that are of our own making, and it would be kind of indulging in a cliche fest to even list them, so I'm not going to. But one of the things that I loved was there's an essay in the book by a writer named Eileen Crist, and the way she speaks about things really does give us a fresh understanding, and I wanted to read a quotation aloud from that essay. She says, you know, she's talking about this idea that 10 billion people on the earth is inevitable, which is one of the kind of memes that's going around in the world. And she writes, "The issue is not whether it is possible for 10 billion people to eat industrial food, commune with iPhones, and make a decent living on planet Earth, an outlying scenario in my view, but perhaps stranger things have happened in the universe. The point to focus on instead is that a world with so many billions does not in any case turn out well, because such a world is only possible by taking a spellbindingly life-abundant planet and turning it into a human food plantation, gridded with industrial infrastructures, webbed densely by networks of high-traffic global trade and travel, in which remnants of natural areas are zoned for ecological services and ecotourism." And to me, that was such a powerful statement on what our presence and what this 10 billion number means for wildlands on this earth.
I agree completely about Eileen Crist's beautiful writing and that thought in particular. The book, as you've already said, is really anchored by this series of photo essays. It's highly visual, but it is bracketed by a few essays, an introduction, a foreword, and Eileen Crist's beautiful afterword, which she entitled Planet of Life, because that is the point that she was making in the quote that you just read and in the full essay, that our vision should not be of an Earth manipulated simply as a feeding factory for one species, but we should perceive it as a community of life. And that idea of humans being embedded in a matrix, a seamless web of life, that's the oldest idea in human experience, but it's one that we have forgotten. For the vast, vast majority of human history, we lived in that seamless fabric of life, surrounded and intermixed with other creatures in this web of connectivity. It's only very, very recently where we've assumed lordship or sovereignty over the rest of the community of life and decided that our fellow neighbors and our members, fellow members in the community of life, we don't call them our neighbors anymore or our kin folks. We call them natural resources. We assume that the other creatures and the other processes and all of the Earth's abundance is simply here for us. That is a false notion, I think, and certainly Eileen Crist in that essay dissects it very skillfully and posits an alternative, that is, moving back toward our deepest human experience as full member in the community of life, which would mean, in practice, a much lower human population and much lower impact on the rest of life, on the biosphere. And there are ways, of course, to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, to get to that place and to have that conversation, it's so important, as Eileen Crist points out, how we talk about things, like whether animals are called natural resources or livestock, whether oceans are called fisheries, whether rivers are called water sources, things like that. The idea that we are somehow engaged, and she doesn't use the word biodiversity as much as she uses life, because life is more than a scientific concept. It's like this totality of what makes everything, what makes us who we are. And I think using that kind of more perhaps poetic or concrete, non-economic, non-scientific language is part of this whole conversation.
It is. Now, this isn't, you know, an explicit theme necessarily of the book over, but it is something that you'll find in Eileen Crist's writings and others, that the way we use language shapes our cognitive frames. This is clearly understood. If we speak of the Earth as our mother and the rest of the community of life as simply that, as our sisters and brothers, we're going to treat the planet and the rest of life in a different way than if we call them natural resources and assume that they're here for us. So the power of language is really important in that shifting attitude. And so is, but our, besides these the ways we talk about these issues, it's just really important that we do start talking about population, which is the elephant in the room, that has become essentially a taboo subject. And the reasons for that are many and varied, probably more than we have time to talk about. But the political forces from both the left and the right that have made population a taboo subject in recent decades have done a great disservice to our ability to focus on the root driver of so many of these other questions. Now, I'll give you an analogy. If in your neighborhood, every evening, a house or two was exploding and burning down, and the community started to say, that, well, this is happening day after day, and it's a crisis. But the response was, well, we need more fire trucks and a bigger budget for the fire department. Or we need different building codes so it's all masonry construction and it can't burn. If that was the level of discourse about this public crisis, this crisis to public health, and no one dared say, well, is there a gas leak or is there an arsonist on the loose? What's causing the fires? We would think that that was absurd. But yet, in the question of how the Earth is being transformed by human numbers and our behavior, this root cause, these root drivers, are typically not addressed. We'll talk about climate change and climate chaos. We'll talk about the problems of energy policy or social inequity. We'll talk about violent strife between different cultures that's at least sometimes amplified by resource scarcity. But we don't talk about population explosion and the explosion of consumption in the overdeveloped world. And it's time that we have to be doing that again if we're going to get serious about addressing the root causes of so many of these other issues that we're just trying to treat the symptoms.
We're talking to Tom Butler about the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. So let's talk about it. What are some of the reasons for overpopulation?
Well, very simply this, humans are very, very good at reproducing ourselves. It's a natural thing to do. And we've gotten, very recently in human history, we've gotten very good at controlling how quickly we die. Death control, with the arrival of modern medicine and public health and modern science, has made humans live a lot longer, and in many parts of the world, with much cushier surroundings and conditions. It took all of human history, as a species, to about roughly 1800 for the human population to reach 1 billion. And yet, since roughly the start of the Industrial Revolution, around 1800, we've now expanded by more than 7 times, and we use an estimated more than 30 times energy per capita as we did at the start of the Industrial Revolution. So if you think about that one-time energy windfall of fossil fuel resources, coal, oil, natural gas, being discovered and being able to be exploited, the absolute explosion in scientific understanding in modern medicine, our populations ballooned very, very quickly. We were able to feed a lot of people. We were able to stay alive a lot longer. And only more recently, primarily in the overdeveloped countries, have fertility rates come down so that they're at or below replacement level. And in many parts of the world, in the high fertility countries, they're still well far above replacement level. And so there is a tremendous demographic momentum still as this huge cohort of human beings that are just reaching their prime reproductive years comes into adulthood. So the momentum is there still for a huge amount of population growth. And that's why it's absolutely urgent that those of us in the overdeveloped world be helping do the things that we know can alleviate suffering for individual families and for societies in the underdeveloped world by giving people the option and the control over their own fertility. And this is well known that if you elevate the status of women and you educate girls and you make family planning tools and information universally available, birth rates come down, and they come down very quickly, and that happens across many different kinds of cultures. So these things are well understood, they're well known, they're not hard to implement, and they are a way of empowering individual men and women in their family planning decisions.
The figure that gets floated around all the time, I hear it, it's mentioned in your book, is the figure 10 billion. And by sometime in, I think, this century, we're supposed to reach 10 billion people in the world. But it's one of those numbers that...
It's an abstraction.
It's an abstraction. It's potentially a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's also like saying there's no choice in the matter.
Well, that's a point also that Eileen Crist, yes, makes in her afterword essay, that it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy, that we'll be going that direction toward an Earth of 10 billion if we don't act. But there is no reason that we have to. The United Nations population projections produces kind of low, medium, and high variance of their projected numbers. The medium variant has us reaching almost 10 billion by the year 2050. But we don't have to. Again, if nations around the world and individuals also make their own family planning decisions based on a kind of a vision of a planet of life, of humanity embedded in wild nature and both nature and people flourishing, family size can go down. And it can go down quickly. And therefore, the demographic trajectory can get through that hump and start to decline quickly as well, which would be a great boon in eliminating human suffering, particularly for those people in super high fertility countries, but also a boon to eliminating suffering among the non-human world, all the fellow creatures with which we share the planet. So these things are not difficult to do. The question of this 10 billion and the demographics conversation being an abstraction is, I think, part of the problem, though. If the UN releases a report, which they periodically do, and it says, oh, well, the Earth's population is supposed to be X number more billions of people added in X number of decades, I can't understand what that means. I can't imagine really what is another billion people in 15 years or another 2 billion by the year 2050. I can't get my head around that, and I doubt very many people can truly imagine what a billion people is. But if I put it this way, most of us, at least in the United States, have gone to a big stadium to see a concert or a professional baseball game. Where I live in my part of the country, there's a famous one in Boston called Fenway Park, home of the Red Sox. And if I go to a game at Fenway Park and I'm there with roughly 40,000 other people, it feels like you're with a lot of human beings. And if someone makes a great play and the place erupts in cheers, it feels loud. You're in a mass of humanity. Now think about filling up Fenway Park not just once or twice or three times, but 5.5 ballparks full of people. And I can imagine that. And that's the number of new people that come to the breakfast table on Earth every 24 hours. And we would want, of course, those people to have the ability to eat breakfast and lunch and dinner and have a decent quality of life, as well as leave enough room on Earth for all the other creatures to be able to eat breakfast and fulfill their dreams and their destinies for their progeny as well. So this is a huge, huge problem. And for the most part, nobody's talking about it. Thus the desire to produce the book and the population speakout.org campaign and website.
One of the things that's necessary is, when we talk about the question of choice to reproduce, whose choice are we talking about? And it really brings up cultural issues, particularly in male-dominated societies, where what it means is kind of letting go of their domination, sharing power, having a vision of equality, which, I mean, we I wish we had more of that kind of equality here in the U.S., but in a lot of other countries, as you say, especially these high reproductive population countries, we're not even close.
You're right. It is a huge challenge. And part of the question of serving the women around the world, the estimated 225 million women who do not wish to become pregnant yet are not using a modern form of contraception. That's a huge gap, and it's often talked about in terms of a supply chain problem. If you can just get the family planning tools, the contraceptives, and the information to underserved areas, then problem solved. Well, that's only part of the problem. That is an issue for sure, and it's a very inexpensive one in terms of total cost. The other part of that problem is the cultural shift. It's those things that I mentioned before about elevating the status of women, educating girls, and working toward gender equity in societies. That is a significant cultural challenge. And clearly, women, if they do not have autonomy over their own reproductive choices, the most kind of egregious example of that is women, young girls sold into child marriage. If you're 8 or 9 years old and given over to wed a man who is 3 or 4 times your age and you become pregnant at 12 or 13, you're likely to lead a life of limited possibility, limited flourishing, and so many, the curtailment of possibility is represented in that idea. Yet it also has kind of demographic ramifications. If age of first marriage is at 12 or 13, or age of first birth, rather, at 12 or 13 or 14. So the societal and the cultural shifts necessary are a huge challenge. And part of the reason we wanted to do this book with our partners at Population Media Center was because they are the group that is doing some of the most interesting and creative work in this field. They have produced and broadcast long-running radio novellas, basically radio soap operas in more than 50 countries around the world that model social norms and have a huge stream of social content. And these kinds of long-running radio and, in cases of telenovelas, television broadcast programs have great effect in helping shift social norms. Now, I can't say that this is going to be a miracle that's going to happen overnight, but these things, these kinds of programs also work in shifting attitudes toward the use of contraception and child marriage and other issues. And they also need to be fully funded and fully implemented wherever we possibly can do that.
So when we talk about limiting population, we're talking also inevitably about limiting growth and, I mean, if all goes well, actually reversing growth. There are visions of a human population on Earth which range from sort of 1 to 2 billion as being sustainable for this planet, and that's way less than we have even now, much less the 10 billion. And in the face of that, we have free market capitalism, which is the ideology of growth, and it's so hard to imagine a world in which the capitalists who are in charge of so much of the world we live in now, this sort of globalized economy, will choose a vision of humility and limitation and quietly buy into a vision of a shrinking world economy, a kind of like fall-winter metaphor as opposed to the burgeoning spring that seems to be at the root of our kind of growth ideology.
Well, I'm not going to be terribly optimistic that the great titans of industry and the captains of capitalism are going to rush to embrace an idea of economic contraction, degrowth, and flourishing wild nature. I doubt that's the case. Maybe in a few cases that will happen if some of those individuals have such a transformation, which does occasionally happen. That would be wonderful. The reality is this. The Earth is finite. Our current dominant economic model assumes that perpetual growth on a finite planet is possible. but it is not possible. It is impossible to grow perpetually on a finite planet. And therefore, an economic model that is based on perpetual growth is going to fail. Now, it's going to, maybe not today or tomorrow, but at some point it will. The late economist Kenneth Boulding once quipped that the only one who believes in perpetual growth on a finite planet is either a madman or an economist. And he should have known, because he certainly was a revered and well-known economist. So our economic model is one that cannot persist. What replaces it, we don't know. Whether that will be some sort of a steady state economy based on capitalism or some other economic model. But at some point, it will change, or we will cause ourselves to go extinct. We will make a planet that is simply not habitable for human beings. And I hope that is not the case, because I want to have a world where human beings flourish alongside wolves and bears and whales and all the other creatures in the biotic community. Getting our economic model right is part of that issue, but so, of course, is getting our numbers and our behavior right. Again, if we look to older parts of human history, we have to remember this is just a blip in human history that we have organized ourselves this way, that is, to grow super rapidly and to consume super rapidly based on this windfall of fossil energy. So, my own view on this is that there is a lot of energy of people who are thinking about creating steady-state economies and a degrowth movement that looks toward alternative forms of economic organization that support human economies that are much more local, much more resilient, and much more suited for an energy-scarce future.
I think one of the things that's also difficult for ordinary people, middle-class Americans, say, or what's left of the middle class, to conceptualize is what the role of their everyday actions really is. And it's something that I struggle with and don't, you know, sometimes I think it, whatever I do, it doesn't matter because I'm one person in this gigantic sweep of momentum of this fossil fuel-based economy. And so I'm ordering my dog's arthritis medicine that comes in a plastic bottle from Lord knows where, which is, there's a kind of absurdity that to that, but I keep doing it, and we all do our versions of those kinds of things. And the, you know, the bottom line is, I mean, at least in my view and that of so many people, middle class life is really nice, and we don't want to give it up, and yet it's based on an unsustainable model, and it's hard to know what to do with that.
It is difficult. You're right. Those of us in the overdeveloped world who have been living in a time of extreme abundance and incredibly cheap energy have gotten a sort of misperception about what the world can support. The fact that a person like me, living in northern New England, where people have lived for thousands of years, incidentally, there have been cultures of human beings who've lived here, where I live, for thousands of years. But only in the last few years was it possible for people who live in northern New England in the middle of January to eat strawberries or blueberries that were grown in Chile or Argentina and flown in an airplane to get to a supermarket in Vermont. That is the kind of absurdity, an economic absurdity, that is based on incredibly inexpensive energy and a technological civilization fueled by cheap energy. That is likely not to persist very much longer. And it doesn't mean that we can't have a good quality of life. I'll give you just another example from my neighborhood. There's a building, that probably one of the nicest buildings in the local village in the town next to me. My office used to be just down the block. It's a 16-sided church, built in the early 1800s. It was, that church is one of the nicest pieces of architecture in Vermont. And people come from all over when they come to New England in the fall to look at the colorful leaves. They drive to Richmond's famous round church, and they go in and they hear the acoustics and they look at the 16 sides and hear about how the community of people who lived in this town roughly two centuries ago, how they came to build that building. Well, they built that building before there was an oil well drilled in North America. And really, at roughly the same time, people were first starting to hack coal out of mines in northern England. And people were playing glorious symphonies in concert halls in Vienna 100 years before that. So the idea that when we have a smaller imprint on the earth and we are organized in different economic models with a lower impact, that we're somehow all going to have to go back to the caves, I think is silly. We can have a wonderful quality of life. We can allow human beings to flourish embedded in a matrix of wild nature, even while not destroying the planet. It's absolutely possible, but it requires some vision and talking about it. And one of the ways to get there, of course, as quickly as possible, is to talk about it as much as possible, because we won't address any of these kinds of overconsumption and overpopulation issues until there is a big, vigorous, robust public conversation about the questions. And that, of course, is, again, is the point of the book and its related campaign.
Tell us more about the work of the Population Media Center and your partners with whom you created this book.
Well, Population Media Center is an amazing organization founded by William Ryerson, has a terrific team of individuals there. They have used what is known as the SABIDO methodology of social change communications, building all of their programs. Miguel SABIDO was a former TV executive who began developing telenovelas with social content for Mexican television several decades ago. And he based his theories also on the work of some academics. So Population Media Center has taken that kind of technique and that body of academic literature and become the most adept organization at going into a country, hiring the local actors and producers, social scientists who will do a baseline study on whatever particular issue they're trying to influence, and try to get a kind of a sense of where the population is at with their social attitudes on that topic. Then they'll run maybe a year long or a year and a half long, these long-running radio soap operas in which characters go through story arcs, and some of the characters make certain choices and things turn out some ways, and some make other choices and doesn't turn out so well. And like anyone who's ever watched a soap opera, you immediately get hooked. You want to know what's going to happen, and the conflict and the excitement of the interactions and the relationships. Well, all of that is just a great technique for making people think about various kinds of social issues. And we're in the more than 50 countries that Population Media Center has worked now running these kinds of social change communications. They've just had tremendous success in influencing contraceptive use and helping to influence cultural norms about family size and other issues. So it's really exciting work, and since I'm actually just a fan and not a staff person, I would recommend anyone who wants to know more to go to the Population Media Center website and read more about their efforts and support that superb organization.
Let's go back to the photographs. We're talking about the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, and because we're doing a radio interview, much as I might hold the book up to the microphone, our listeners can't see the exquisite, amazing photographs. But tell us more about the process of putting all this together.
Well, first of all, it was a great, great project. It was really interesting to do, and we had a wonderful little editorial team with an art director, a photo researcher, a graphic designer, and all. That photo researcher who we worked with, Daniel Dancer is his name, really found thousands and thousands of images that we looked at. And the charge to him was essentially go out and look for photos that show us how the Earth is being transformed by human numbers and behavior. Very simple. And that didn't mean just show us the most egregious examples or the most outrageous examples. We do have some of those. You know, when you see a picture of the tar sands unconventional oil development in Alberta, where boreal forest of Canada is being transformed into something that looks like Mordor out of Lord of the Rings, you can't help think, oh, you know, this is a horrific example of a toxic energy economy. So there are some images like that in the book, But there are also ones that we wanted to just be representative of daily life. What does it look like for those people on the train platform in Bangladesh who are trying to catch the train and get to work? Or what does it look like for some people in Beijing trying to get through the middle of the day in a cloud of smog and air pollution that is so thick it appears that dusk is falling? You can barely see where you're going. So many, many of the images were just like that, kind of showing the way that people live and the way the earth is being negatively influenced by our numbers and our behavior. That effort to go through those images and select the ones that we thought were most appropriate for these different photo sequences about how we feed ourselves or how we run our energy economy or air quality or water, these things were the kinds of choices were really fun and also really disturbing. Because when you pour through enough images of death and destruction, really, for the natural world and suffering for the people who are on the bottom rung of humanity in terms of their socioeconomic status, it's emotionally wrenching. And we felt like we had a strong desire to be as honest as we could in putting out those images, in making a representative sample. And if nothing else, even if this campaign doesn't end up flourishing, although the reaction to the initial campaign has been amazing, there's, at least some value in sort of bearing witness. This is where we are.
Yeah.
This is what the Earth, this beautiful little blue-green planet in the blackness of space, what it looks like at this particular moment in time.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that people who were interested in, for example, just photography itself. I mean, one of the comparisons that came to mind as I was looking at that was there's a lot of early 20th century photographs where really great photographers were commissioned to go into like the Ford plant and make beautiful pictures of industrialism.
Yeah.
And those photographs were imbued with a sense of hope and a sense of a future in which people will be able to drive cars and the liberation that was involved with that and the economic growth, which at the time was in a country where so many people really didn't have enough. And the fact that in such a short time, that aesthetic seems really kind of quaint and old-fashioned and it's just turned 180 degrees. That in itself is just so, so interesting.
It is interesting. In those kinds of images of a fanciful future where everyone is empowered and technological progress would continue forever. Essentially, it's that vision, the Star Trek vision, you know, through innovation and economic growth and technology, we will all kind of reach this greater and greater level of material affluence as we shoot ourselves out into the universe and spread through the heavens. Based on the reality of what we see around us in terms of climate chaos, social inequity, resource limits, the wildlife extinction crisis, that kind of Star Trek vision seems less and less possible to most of us, I think, or at least to some of us. And it is an interesting time to be a human being, to be alive, and to be thinking about these issues. Incidentally, since you've sort of settled these last couple of questions on the photography in the book, I should say that any listeners who want to see the images, in fact, can leaf through online the entire book at populationspeakout.org at the website. Incidentally, if you don't mind, I'll comment on just a couple of the photos in the book that I find particularly emotionally compelling.
Yeah.
Of course, anyone leafing through the book or going onto the website and are going to find images they find most interesting or most compelling. But for me, there are a couple that are especially notable. And one of them is a photo of a thresher shark. It's been caught in a net, a fishing net, off the coast of Mexico. And it was an underwater image by an amazing photographer named Brian Scarry, who's caught this shark in a vertical orientation. Looks almost like it's being crucified in this net. What gets me about that image is the snuffing out of beauty, the loss of potential, the loss of wildness and integrity and potential for that creature to pursue its life in a wild underwater ocean habitat. A similar image that I find so wrenching is one of these two young girls in Yemen. And when you first, leafing through the book, and you see these two girls with men, you think that, well, that's their fathers. But then when you see the caption in context, you realize that both of these girls, who were 8 years old when the photo was taken, are these men's wives. They've been sold as child brides. And I think the same kind of idea is represented. I find it so moving, I think, because I'm the father of a young daughter, and I know what I would want for her, a life of beauty and potential and finding her way in the world and living her dreams. And I think of those two little girls in Yemen, and I can only imagine a life that is much darker, much more constrained. And the idea of those girls being sold into marriage when they're 8 years old, or that thresher shark whose life has been snuffed out by industrial fishing off the coast of Mexico, both represent this idea of control, of dominion, of industrialization, or kind of trying to have hegemony over others, other creatures, or in this case, over young women. And both horrific idea and both really startling photos.
And not to get too deep into ecofeminist theory, but there is this sense of, I mean, male dominion over women and nature as woman and that kind of dominion over nature, as opposed to a kind of give and take conversation that we have with nature and that nature is always having, because there is, in fact, a food chain where creatures eat other creatures and so on.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because this question of patriarchy is infused in the book. Now, it's not explicitly and directly addressed too much, but it's always there. And I made the intentional choice when I wrote an opening parable that precedes the photo essays in the book to call that parable Lord Man, which is a phrase that John Muir used in his writings more than 100 years ago to refer to this idea of human beings thinking themselves sovereign over the others, or the other creatures on Earth. In fact, there's a famous John Muir quote he once wrote, and I'm slightly paraphrasing, but he said, if it came to a war between Lord Man and the wild beasts, I'd be tempted to side with the bears. And he used that phrase explicitly, you know, with a sense of condescension or derision toward people who thought they were better than the rest of nature and had assumed this idea of lordship. I wanted to use that phrase because of its implicit patriarchy, because so much of the problem we see in this kind of desire to have dominion over the earth and have control over the earth and for men to have control over women stems from this idea of patriarchal attitudes. And it's a huge problem. And getting beyond that, or getting into that, is necessary if we're going to solve these bigger societal questions.
The name of the book is Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And I actually had to look up the word overshoot in the dictionary, and it means to go past a point unintentionally, especially through traveling too fast or being unable to stop. And I thought, that's the metaphor for where we are right now. We're traveling so fast.
That's right, we are. And it also has a different, slightly different but related definition in ecology. When ecologists talk about ecological overshoot or overshooting the carrying capacity of a particular habitat, they're referring to that phenomenon whereby a species becomes so abundant, overly abundant, that it begins to degrade the habitat. You know, if it's overshot the carrying capacity, begins to degrade that habitat, the habitat declines in quality, and eventually the population can no longer be supported. You get a population crash and decline. So, in effect, you can think of the title of the book in a form of an equation that overpopulation, that is numbers, just how many of us there are, 7.3 billion and growing fast, plus overdevelopment, and we can use that term as a stand-in for all that we consume of the Earth's natural bounty, equals overshoot. The way we have already outstripped the carrying capacity of the Earth and its renewable systems to support human life and all of the other creatures. And we can see the reality of that overshoot in the global wildlife extinction crisis, the loss of biodiversity. We can see it in global climate chaos, the fact that our unintended side effect of burning fossil fuels, a whole lot of it as fast as we could over the last two centuries, has effectively broken the climate in which our species evolve. So this problem of ecological overshoot is the fundamental issue of our time, but it's the one that we're not really talking about in terms of the drivers and the root systemic causes. We mostly dance around the edges talking about the symptoms. Thus, again, the book Over and the campaign at populationspeakout.org to help people think about this issue, talk about it, become emotionally connected to this question of human population and numbers and behavior, and begin to address it and clamor for change.
The book is full of quotations which you've assembled, one for each image, and one of them that stood out to me was one by our own American Henry David Thoreau, who wrote, "Most men, it appears to me, do not care for nature and would sell their share in all her beauty for as long as they may live for a stated and not very large sum. Thank God they cannot yet fly and lay waste to the sky as well as the earth. We are safe on that side for the present. It is for the very reason that some do not care for these things that we need to combine to protect all from the vandalism of the few." And I thought, boy, that sure was a prescient quote.
It was prescient, wasn't he? Henry David Thoreau was something. He was a bit of a crank there, but boy, was he a brilliant guy, and he was certainly looking ahead. I think what he was expressing there comes from a kind of an understanding of human nature to an extent, but also came out of what he was seeing at his particular moment in time at the front end of the Industrial Revolution arriving in America, the rapid industrialization and conversion of wild places that he knew. We have gone way, way past in that process of conversion and industrialization of the earth, way, way past perhaps whatever even Henry David Thoreau might have imagined, or John Muir, or one of these, or any of the other great kind of pioneers in conservation from American conservation history. But if the problem in front of us is this equation, overpopulation plus overdevelopment equals overshoot, there is another equation that is an antidote to that. And that is the idea, at least in my view, this is not addressed in the book, but it is my own opinion that the antidote to that is nature needs half. This is a meme that is starting to gain traction. I once, or just a few weeks ago, listened to the eminent biologist Edward O. Wilson give a keynote lecture at a conference on this topic where he said, essentially, we know from the science that if we want to sustain all the biological diversity, that is, all of the life's diversity and richness and beauty and creation on the land and in the seas, essentially, we need to set aside half of the land and half of the seas for nature,
Yeah. Strictly
protected. And we can do that and still allow human civilization to flourish. And here are the ways. He spoke very pointedly about this being not just this idea of nature needs half, not just being ethically correct and scientifically defensible, but also politically achievable. If we have vision and courage and the capacity to address these questions and get humanity through this demographic bottleneck of numbers and behavior and begin to get our trajectory, our demographic trajectory back going down the right way to a smaller, more sustainable human population that is allowing all of life to flourish.
Tom Butler is editor of the new book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And the Population Media Center is at populationmedia.org. The Global Population Speakout is at populationspeakout.org. And finally, the Population Institute is at populationinstitute.org. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe and for bringing us this exquisite book.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.